7th town hall with President Trump this week, and particularly because so many Americans really need answers. Want answers. We want to know what's going to happen. I mean, are we going back to work? Are we going to be reopening our small businesses? When will our kids go back to school? I mean, these are all questions we need answered. And it's important that the president continue to speak directly to the American people. I thought he did a phenomenal job with Fox News, with Bret Baier and Martha McCallum. It was incredible how he was able to talk about the things that matter to us most, because he was talking directly to us, right? Americans were able to send in their questions via Skype, straight to Fox, Martha McCallum, Bret Baier, asking those questions directly to the president and, you know, holding the administration accountable. Because, look, we are all in this together. That's pretty obvious. And what's happening in our country and this lockdown, which I call it a global economic lockdown, right? This is not just about us. It's all across the globe. And how we're handling this is going to determine the next decade. How are we going to get out of this? And what's going to happen to our children? I talked about it last night as well, right after the town hall with President Trump. Was with Congressman Matt Gaetz, as well as Lisa Booth. She's a contributor. So we want to really put the focus on that. Let the American people do what they do best, right? Make those decisions for themselves and empower them to do the right thing. That's how you run this country. And that's what President Trump said. He believes in us. He believes in each one of us as individuals to have common sense and to do the right thing. And I loved how he said, you know, for those that are 60 and older, I mean, if you're concerned, you can stay at home, because we don't want people to get sick. We don't want to see any more people die. Adam, I would like you to play, if you can right now, the clip from Trump's Sunday town hall on Fox News, if you get a chance.
As president, what do you say to the people who are scared to go back to work on one side? And what do you say to the people who are really angry about these lingering closures?
Well, I think you can satisfy both. If you're scared, you're going to stay back a little bit and you're going to watch it. And I think anyone over 60, because we have pretty good, we have a pretty good roadmap right now. Anybody over 60, you could say 65, but let's make it 60. We have to protect those people and we have to watch it. And maybe they stay back longer. But no, I think you can really have it both ways. I think a lot of people want to go back. They just want to go back. You see it every day. You see demonstrations all over the country. And those are meaningful demonstrations. Oh, it's big stuff. But you also have some people that are very scared. Probably everybody's scared when you get right down to it. It's a terrible thing, that happened to our country. It came from China. It should have been stopped. It could have been stopped on the spot. They chose not to do it, or something happened. Either there was incompetence or they didn't do it for some reason. And we're going to have to find out what that reason was. But people are absolutely scared. But there are other people that are scared about being locked in a room and losing their job and not having any income. And, you know, for the first time, these are workers. These are people that want to get back and work and make a living. And they're afraid their job's not going to be there. And at a certain point, if you keep it going too long, that's going to happen. So I understand that very well.
Absolutely. And so do we. And the reason we played that whole clip is so that you can hear directly from your president. He understands what's happening here. He understands the frustration, the mounting frustration, because according to sources that I've spoken to, they can see it in the White House. There's a concern. He wants to ensure everyone's safety, doesn't want to see any more deaths, but there's also over 30 million unemployment applications and a really uncertain future for a lot of people. So you can do both. There's a way to do this. And I believe in that. But today, folks, I am so, so thrilled. We have a very, very special guest. His name is Nigel West. He is a military historian specializing in security and intelligence issues. He is probably one of the most world-renowned historians when it comes to intelligence. And I'm not just talking Great Britain. He is from Great Britain. I'm not talking about British intelligence. I'm talking about U.S. intelligence, British intelligence, the GRU. He has done phenomenal work. His most recent book is Churchill's Spy Files, an examination of Prime Minister Winston Churchill's monthly wartime briefings on MI5's counter-espionage operations. But he is here to talk about Christopher Steele, who is a friend of his. was a friend of his. And the validation of Christopher Steele's dossier, whether or not it was validated, it was not validated. In fact, it was Nigel West's job to go through Christopher Steele's dossier. There's 17 parts that comprise this dossier. He went through it line by line, and he is going to tell you what he found, what he discovered, and the disappointment in what he found. And we have breaking news coming out on Christopher Steele here. That's what I've got to say. We also have Mark Lauder on the show today. I'm very excited to have Mark on. He is the director for strategic communications for the Donald J. Trump 2020 campaign. He talks about Nigel West's findings. What does this mean to us? What does this mean to the American people? That's very important because we're moving forward. And remember, Attorney General William Barr and Prosecutor John Durham are investigating this. And Nigel West is somebody that is respected throughout the world. He does not mince words. He's about facts. And he has debunked. He has debunked agents in the past that have told tall tales or have lied in books. And what he has to say, you will not want to miss. Nigel, thank you so much for being on the show with me today. It's such a pleasure. I'm such a fan. I'm very excited. People usually don't see me this excited to have someone on the show. But I want you to give a little bit of your background to our viewers and our listeners, because your work is respected all over the world. Some of the top intelligence agencies have called you the premier historian of intelligence, not only Great Britain, but U.S. as well as Russian intelligence. Tell us a little bit about your past so that people understand when we get into Christopher Steele. And as I told all the listeners and all of you out there that are listening right now in the program, Nigel did know Christopher Steele. He was friends with him. And this is about his report. But before we get into that, I want Nigel to explain some of his work and work history.
Well, I've been involved in the intelligence world since university, when I wrote to an author who happened to be an intelligence officer and asked him about a particular point in his book. And he said he hired me on the spot as a researcher. And so my background really is has always been as a researcher. And at university, I then moved on to another author, helped him, then started writing books myself. Then got engaged within the intelligence community, became something of a mole hunter at one stage, not very successful. Then graduated to teaching and training intelligence officers in the United States. And I guess that I've written a few books on the way. Some of them are quite difficult to read because they're more like textbooks for the intelligence community. So they're sort of encyclopedias, case histories of counterintelligence. And others are just really interesting cases, counterintelligence cases of double agents, regular spies, case officers, and so on. So it covers the whole range.
So you're being very modest, but you do have that long history of understanding intelligence. And I think this is why this is so important. First, so I'm going to start off with Christopher Steele, because that's what most people are interested in here in the United States. And I want you to explain maybe your history with Christopher Steele, the relationship you had with him in the past, and what led you to writing this report before we get into the details about the report. And for all of you out there listening, the reason why Nigel is so important is because he can look at these reports and assess them the way he would in the past, like through historical context. He's able to look at the evidence or the so-called evidence in these dossiers that were put there apparently by sources Christopher Steele said he had, and be able to assess whether or not were these legitimate assets, were these legitimate people, is this information accurate, where did this information come from. So he's an expert at looking at these documents and then gaining that analysis, and this is what he's done in the past. through his historical research, and this is what he did now. But I want you to establish, Nigel, your relationship with Christopher Steele so that people understand your history with him.
Yes. Let me explain that I've been friends with him for some years. I worked with him at RAF Molesworth on a counterintelligence project for NATO. I have known his work and I have admired him, and I know the details of his career. By way of background, it's also worth saying that amongst the books that I've written were two on people who have claimed to have written books about their own authentic experiences behind enemy lines in the Second World War as agents. So I wrote a book called Counterfeit Spies, exposing 25 books that have been written by people who claimed to have been active in the clandestine world. In fact, they were fabricators. So I have a nose for the fabricators. After I'd written that book, various people pointed out to me other books that they were suspicious of in the Cold War. I amounted another 25 books that were bogus and exposed them in a book called Counterfeit Spies of the Cold War. So that is my background. In 2017, when the Steele dossier was published, I was hired by an American lawyer in Washington to write a counterintelligence analysis of Chris Steele's dossier. I had not really read Chris Steele's dossier in detail, and I hadn't done a counterintelligence analysis of it. And it's worth just explaining that an analyst is the person who sits behind the reports officers and the case officers who run the individual agents. And it is fair to say that I have never run an agent in my life, but I've probably met more agents, double agents, and case officers than anybody else on the planet, only because of assiduous research over 40 years. So I was hired to write this analysis of Chris Steele's dossier, which I did dispassionately, without political bias, and without any partisan view. And my analysis was line by line.
Now, that's what Christopher Steele tries to say before we get into that, that he's saying, well, you were paid by, a Republican-backed lawyer or somebody that is conservative, so you were going to be biased against him. But your ability to discern and the work that you've done in the past by debunking claims from people that maybe told tall tales, wrote books about their involvement in the spy agencies. You're saying that you came into this objective, knowing Christopher Steele, having been his friend, taking this on. What were your first thoughts? Were you thinking at first, oh, look, I've known this man. It's going to be fine. This dossier is going to be, it's probably going to be solid. Or did you go in just thinking, questioning, maybe, what was in the dossier?
It's hard to look back and really assess what my view was. But I think that I had taken quite a positive view, just knowing Chris. Because I should explain that he was the go-to guy in the Russian emigre world in the UK, where all the Russians tended to congregate. And if you were somebody who wanted to invest in an emerging market in Eastern Europe, and you were concerned about the company that you were investing in, the directors, the shareholders, you wanted to know whether or not any of them had been embargoed or sanctioned with the subject of US Treasury sanctions, EU sanctions, the person that you would go to and the people that I would recommend would be one of two companies. One was called GPW, very good. And these are people who do due diligence. So if you're a banker looking at a loan for an investment in Russia or that area, you would go, you'd do your due diligence. You'd go to one of these companies, and they were staffed, are staffed, very largely by former intelligence officers because they know the territory. And Chris was the go-to guy. If you wanted to know about the oligarch's connections with organized crime, then he was the person to go to. So that was the background, and I have always respected him. And just to give you an idea of the respect that he was held in, for 3 years he headed the INEC, which is the Intelligence Officer's New Entry Course, which is a training program. I know that in the States, the Bureau and the agency tend to send officers who have a problem or a dud in some way. Very often they're sent to training. But in the UK, we take training very seriously because we want to imbue new intelligence officers with the doctrine and with the tradecraft that is successful. And so the very best officers actually go to give training to new personnel. So that's what Chris's background was. And so when I looked at the document and started to do a line-by-line assessment, what you do is you just simply work out, where did that information come from? Which source is it attributed to? And is that person identifiable in any other way? And that source validation, it's fairly straightforward, and it's what good journalists will do when they're trying to authenticate a story that they've been given. And it's the same in the intelligence world.
What shocked you? Tell us, when you started going through line by line through Christopher Steele's dossier and if you want multiple reports, let's say multiple reports, when people think of the dossier, it was a compilement of multiple reports.
17 reports altogether.
Correct. 17 reports. What struck you as odd right off the bat? And when you came to that conclusion, what went through your mind? Here's somebody that you had a lot of faith in, maybe in the past, because you've seen his work and you considered him a friend. And all of a sudden you're looking at this dossier and you notice something right off the bat during your assessment that isn't right, that seems off and wrong. And what goes through your mind right then? Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Two things struck me straight away. First of all, I deal with Russians. I've lectured in Russia. I've written two books with a KGB co-author. I had a desk inside the KGB archives. I know that all that sounds a very odd thing to have done, but I have a good relationship with a lot of KGB officers, and my co-author spent 7 years in the UK working against British interests. And I never thought I'd end up making him a friend, but Oleg Zaryev became a very good friend. And he was a lieutenant colonel in the KGB, had been under journalistic cover in the UK, and we wrote two books together with the consent of the KGB based on documents that they declassified from their archive. So the first thing that I noticed was the speed with which this information was being acquired from the Kremlin. Now, I have friends in the KGB, retirees. I can't correspond with them. It's very difficult to communicate with them. I won't discuss how I communicate with them. But when they come, they'll deny everything. They resent being emailed. It's dangerous for them to telephone or communicate. If I invite them two or three days in Amsterdam, Prague, or Berlin, they're happy as Larry, fabulously indiscreet, and a wonderful, completely different people. You cannot see them in Moscow. So that's the way that it is. And people understand that. And I was very struck by the speed with which Chris was able to get information from Moscow. That just struck me as amazing. The second part of that was his access. To have people who were described as a senior currently serving intelligence officer or a currently serving member of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or somebody with access to Kremlin decision makers, this is what we dream about. The idea that a state-sponsored agency could have these kind of sources would be fantastic. For a private individual to be able to manage and develop and recruit these sources really struck me as quite incredible. But that wasn't the issue. The real issue for me was the line-by-line analysis. And you have to appreciate that the sources to whom the material was attributed were identified as A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. Mm-hmm. So now we take a close look at A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. And what was curious was that one of them seemed to be validated by another source. So F and G appeared to work together. One of them was middle management, apparently based on the information, middle management within the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Moscow.
Right.
So there we know that is one source, and we know that they've been validated by another source who confirms that that's who they are. So that person has access to information about an episode that took place in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel and had spoken secondhand, but had spoken to people who had made up the rooms and therefore knew what had been going on.
This was the infamous PP tape, is what everybody calls it here. The salacious part of the dossier. Yeah.
But it means that that individual is middle management within Ritz-Carlton and had access to this kind of corridor gossip, that canteen gossip that you might expect. Mm-hmm. But that same source, a few months later, turns out to be an expert on cyber warfare. Now, that doesn't sound like the role of somebody in middle management in the Ritz-Carlton. And then that exact same source is attributed as the source of information about money laundering operations being conducted by Russian consular officials out of the consulate in Miami. Now, two big problems about that. There isn't, and there never has been, a Russian consulate in Miami. And how come this cyber warfare expert also works in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel and knows about money laundering through official channels in the United States?
It makes no sense.
It doesn't seem likely to me, but this is the point. It is a common trait of fabricators to mix up their sources. Case officers, intelligence officers, never do that. They will attribute a code name to a particular source that, if they have the opportunity to do so, if it isn't chosen for them, that will remind them who that individual is, so that there is no chance of mixing up a source. And for a professional intelligence officer, to mix up these sources is not only completely unprofessional, but I would say in 40 years' experience, I have never really known it. And let me just explain this. Many years ago, I met an intelligence officer who had run an espionage network in Nazi Germany before the Second World War. He was short of money, and so he became a fabricator. He invented sources in order to get his expenses paid. And these sources were quite expensive. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, how did you remember? You ran real agents. How did you remember who were the fake agents that you were drawing expenses for and your authentic agents? And he said, oh, the fake agents, I always gave them code names that were domestic. So a coffee table, a lampstand, a desk blotter, were my best agents. But I remembered that those were the code names that I attributed to them, and that's how I knew that they were my fakes. Years later, an academic told me that he'd been working in MI6's archives, and he'd come across a fabulous network of brilliant agents in Nazi Germany before the Second World War called Lampstand and Table Blotter. So you can't always trust the archives, but
right.
the way that particular intelligence officer had kept things straight in his mind was by attributing the code names. And it's, if you're telling the truth, this is the reason why police officers use elicitation, use methods to extract information. They ask people to repeat their stories over and over again. Because if you're telling the truth, you know what the story is. If you faked bits of it, then you'll get things wrong.
Right. So Christopher Steele, now there's this report, you know, the Michael Horowitz report, where in the footnotes that have been declassified and unsealed so the public can see, it suggests that there may have been Russian disinformation in his dossier, that the Russians realized Christopher Steele was conducting this investigation and they gave him false information. What you're saying is maybe not. Maybe Christopher Steele made this all up. Maybe it was a combination of both. What do you think actually happened with this dossier and Christopher Steele?
Let's be clear that there is still news emerging. I mean, even last week, as you mentioned, some of the footnotes have been declassified. So the news is still emerging. But what we know is as follows. There were between 5 and 9 individual sources. We know from testimony 2 weeks ago in the High Court in litigation in London, where Chris Steele said under oath that he had met most of these individuals who, quote, work and live in Russia right now, that he met them outside of the country. He hasn't been in Russia for 10 years. So what's interesting is that he says that he paid them, get this, between $4,000 and $6,000 a month. Just bear in mind that he was paid for the entire dossier by Fusion GPS in Washington. We think between $160,000 and $180,000. So if you do the arithmetic, he's making a pretty serious loss on this deal. So the next issue is what you raise: are these fabricated sources, or is there a real source there that has been peddling disinformation? Well, we know that one of the sources that he has attributed most of the information to is a man called Sergei Milian, who's a sort of interesting real estate guy who has vanished. He did give evidence to the Mueller report, but he has disappeared off the face of the earth. And in the intelligence community, that is called a clue. The fact that this person has disappeared is significant. Now, he has acknowledged publicly that he was one of Chris's sources. He has also said that he does not agree with the characterization of much of the information that he supplied Chris. So whether that is embroidery, embellishment, exaggeration, call it what you will, there does appear to have been at least one Russian source for Chris. Slight problem when you look into Sergei Milian's background. He dances around the proposition that he may have himself worked for a Soviet intelligence organization. And when you look back at his career, he acknowledges publicly and is quite sort of entertained by the idea that when he did his compulsory military service for 2 years in the Soviet Union, he did the military interpreter's course in English. And that is run by the GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence. So there is no question by his own admission that he had a relationship with the GRU. Whether that continued into later life is a matter of speculation. Whether he had any kind of a relationship with them, one doesn't know. But he is in Russia now and is not answering his cell phone.
So let me ask you this. Could both be true? Could it be true that Christopher Steele made up information in order to collect money? Maybe he was desperate to be paid. Who knows? I don't know what his financial situation was. And that he also obtained disinformation. So he conflated the disinformation with false information, jumbled it all together in this dossier. And as you went through it line by line, those sources that didn't seem to exist were convoluted with sources that possibly did exist that could have contained disinformation from Sergey Milan.
Precisely that. I think that it is quite likely that Sergey Milan really was some kind of a source, but I think that Chris invented and embroidered and exaggerated beyond that. Now, in the most recent report that has been disclosed, so this was the analysis undertaken by Michael Horowitz, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice. What's fascinating there is that at one stage, halfway through Chris's reportings, he has a meeting in Italy. He is briefed by the FBI, who send a team over from the investigation unit that's been set up to look at the allegations of collusion between the Trump campaign and Moscow. And what's interesting is that when that group of officers goes back to Washington, two of them express concern that they have been the victim of elicitation. In other words, in their meeting with Chris, they were supposed to be directing Chris and tasking him and telling him what they were interested in. But it ended up in them briefing Chris on everything that they knew already and what he should be doing now. And two people in that team, when they got back, wrote memoranda saying, we're really worried. We feel that one of the analysts who was supposed to be conducting the briefing really went much too far. And thereafter, guess what? Chris's reporting concentrates on precisely the things that the FBI want to hear about.
So he was actually soliciting in his expertise, soliciting the information from the people that were supposed to be soliciting the information from him. He was just
precisely. He
was just that good in collecting that information. Do you think, based on what you've seen, based on your expertise, what's happened here in the United States, the involvement of U.S. intelligence, I have said before, the weaponization of intelligence and the politicization of this intelligence as well. What's happened here is something that is highly unusual that we haven't seen in modern political history, one. And two, what does it mean right now, particularly after talking to some of the sources people involved in this, like George Papadopoulos and Carter Page, who had a FISA warrant, and all of them who are saying, look, this goes far beyond just the United States. There were people involved both in the Five Eyes, as well as, you know, sources that we still don't have a full grasp of, like Sergey Milan, Joseph Mifsud. When you look at this as a historian, what are the questions you have? And what do you think actually happened here? What do you think was actually going on?
I think that we will discover that the fabrications go back a long way. And if you look at the relationship between the FBI and Chris, it goes back to the FIFA investigations. Yes. Back in 2010. Now, he left the service in 2009, went into the private sector, and was hired by the English Football Association, to do research on the Russian competition, the bid for the 2018 World Cup. Well, all sorts of things happened, but not quite as Chris said, and he produced two reports for the FBI at that time that now do not stand up to analysis. And that's very interesting. The thing, you touch on a very difficult subject, which is the politicization of the US intelligence community. And two things strike me. One is that how anybody could have taken the Steele report seriously and not done a line-by-line analysis and notice things about it that gave serious cause for concern. The lack of any attempt of validation seems to me to be close to criminal. And how grown-up intelligence officers could have fallen for it or circulated it is to me absolutely breathtaking. And when you look at the tradecraft used by Chris, what also surprises me, and I don't think corruption is too strong a word for it, but not just to produce these documents, but to peddle them, to go round the media and peddle them, and then complain to the FBI that there's been leaks of his own information, and complain to the FBI, who then eventually discover that he was responsible for the leaks in the first place. So quite a lot of people have been played for real suckers in this.
And not only have they been played for real suckers, but an entire system, political system, has been buckled because of it and divided because of disinformation. I mean, and that's just how powerful information can be. It's the most, in my opinion, the most powerful weapon, right? And the most dangerous if it's, especially if it's falsified, if it's used against a particular person. I mean, in most cases, and I believe in Great Britain as well as the United States. And before I wrap this up, because I you brought up a very important point here, Nigel, the use of disinformation in a campaign is almost certainly always, if a United States authorizes it, a lethal authority. Because when you use disinformation, somebody can die, right? There could be misinformation about someone, a world leader, lies spread through the media in an effort to
Let me give you an example. Carter, you mentioned Carter Page.
Correct.
I think by the end of this year, you'll be wanting to pin a medal on him. This is an individual who put his life at risk, who operated as a double agent for the CIA, entrapped three Russian intelligence officers, two of whom were withdrawn, declared persona non grata. The third went to jail. Carter Page, idiot or hero, went back to Russia after he'd participated in that operation. I mean, this is really quite an extraordinary man with an extraordinary story to tell if he's ever allowed to do so.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And you're absolutely right about bringing up Carter Page, because it was fascinating watching the evolution of that and how he kept quiet about his operation, his contacts with the CIA, his being used as an asset. Even when he was being targeted publicly, he never once divulged that. And that's pretty remarkable. He never stepped back to protect himself. He always put his country first. And I don't think people really understand that until they really get to know him. And I've had the opportunity of knowing him and being his friend. I consider him a friend. Well, I don't know what else to say, Nigel, other than I would love for you to come back to the Sarah Carter Show. There is so much I want to talk to you about. There's so much I feel we can learn from you. Is there any last word you'd like to give? Anything that I didn't ask you that's crossed your mind that you wanted to say publicly?
Well, I think what is remarkable is the way in which the Anglo-American relationship has not been too badly damaged by this episode. And I'm delighted by that, because the Five Eyes community relies on mutual trust. I mean, we exchange information, we exchange sources, we exchange methods, and that is vitally important. The sadness is that the general principle, the Sherman-Kent principle of speaking truth unto power, seems to have been lost in the United States with the politicization that has taken place in the past 5 years. And that's a great sadness, but it can be put right.
How? Before I let you go, how?
Professionalism. I think that by taking the sting out of this and by having the truth exposed about the dossier and the full background to this, it's an ugly story, much of it, but the characters involved, frankly, are truly remarkable when you consider that Chris Steele was working at one stage for Oleg Deripaska, one of the oligarchs. Deripaska was trying to get into the United States by offering information about Bob Levinson, who was the FBI special agent who disappeared in Iran. This is stranger than any fiction that John le Carré could ever have imagined. And when the truth comes out, it'll be a bestseller.
Oh, I believe that. I'm expecting to read a book from you on this, I'm thinking, one day. So are you working on one?
Not yet, but you've given me the idea.
Oh, well, I'm glad I did, Nigel West. You know, I didn't have to do that. It was probably sitting there in the back recesses of your brain anyways, getting ready to write probably one of the greatest books in modern political spy history. So thank you so much for being with me today. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to you coming back.
Thank you, Sarah.
That was just an incredible interview with Nigel West, and I will have a write-up at sarahacarter.com on this, so please go to my website, sarahacarter.com, where we can lay out what Nigel West was talking about and this huge problem. I mean, just the fact that, looking at this dossier, going through it line by line, and the fact that Christopher Steele was actually a friend of his, and he's coming out and saying, look, this dossier, I mean, it's not only dodgy, half of it's made up. And then there's concern that there's Russian disinformation in there. And why didn't the FBI validate this? Well, that's why I have Mark Lauder on with us today. And he is not only an incredible person, he is also the director of strategic communications for the Donald J. Trump 2020 campaign. And I'm so happy to have you on, Mark. And really such a big news day, because I was so thrilled to be able to speak to Nigel West today. He was quite a catch. I mean, somebody that's respected throughout the world in the intelligence community, both in the United States. He's spoken at Langley. He's spoken in Russia and Moscow at the GRU. He is a renowned expert from Great Britain on U.S. intelligence and has written a number of books as well on foreign intelligence agencies. And he's debunked a lot of stories too. Other agents that may have lied, handlers. So what do you think? First of all, congratulations on still running this enormous campaign through coronavirus. I want to hear a little bit about that and what you all are doing. And what do you think about this statement from Nigel West that what the FBI did borders on criminal?
Well, I think that's definitely something that needs to be looked at. And we know that John Durham's going to be looking at that, because we also know for a fact that at just about every turn, you had top level officials either at the FBI, the Department of Justice, basically throw out their rule books, throw out the way they have handled most investigations, and let their Trump derangement syndrome get the best of them. Whether it was including the dirty dossier, the unfounded allegations, the Russia disinformation, all the way to how they treated Michael Flynn and everything that they could do to try to get at this president, they did so. And now it's all coming out, as the president has been basically predicting for a number of years, that when the truth finally gets out, it's going to shock America. And that's what we're seeing happening play out right now.
Well, it's been just so devastating, Mark. If you think about what's happened to our country over the last 3.5 years, it wasn't just about targeting the president, which, of course, is what they were doing, but it divided our nation. It divided it so deeply that, I mean, people on the left, liberals that were maybe only listening to Rachel Maddow. By the way, let's just play a clip of that, Adam. There's a clip here I'd like to refresh Mark's memory on. This is Rachel Maddow talking about the dossier and Christopher Steele.
It is definitely true that some of the most salacious stuff, including the personal stuff in the dossier, hasn't been proven out by any subsequent reporting, at least not yet. But there are parts of the dossier that really have been proven out, and that were right about stuff that we now accept was true about the Russian attack on our election. Except the dossier was right about it months before any of the rest of us knew, months before there was any public reporting.
So for those people, Mark, that only watched Rachel Maddow, that only saw CNN in the country, they absolutely started to believe this. We had the former head of the CIA, Director John Brennan, James Clapper, Andy McCabe, James Comey, who have, been nonstop targeting the president of the United States, basically calling him a Manchurian candidate based on a dossier that we now know was fabricated by a former British spy. This is really concerning. So when President Trump says this isn't just about me, it's about America, and it's about, the people who voted for President Trump, he's right.
No, you're absolutely right. And the one thing that I hope comes from this, not only are those who misused their powers, misused the trust and the police powers of the federal government of the United States to target the president of the United States during all of these actions, I really hope that the media will step back and take a look at their complicity and their role in all of this as well. They allowed themselves to be played by some elements of the Obama administration, some elements of the FBI and the DOJ at the highest levels, and they were purveyors of this Russia disinformation. They were the ones who went out there and broadcast it without having it been independently verified. Things that basic journalism 101 students should learn. People like Rachel Maddow, who is no journalist, and MSNBC and CNN, they just threw away their rule books for journalism as well, just because they could get the president, or they wanted to get the president.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree with you more on that. And we're seeing it even now. There's kind of been this like nonstop targeting of the president. And I thought last night's show, his town hall rally with Martha McCallum and Brett Baer on Fox News was really incredible, where people from across the country were able to ask a question. And they did so, on national television. It was held at the Lincoln Memorial, which I think is just absolutely stunning and a really great place to be. Tell me a little bit about what you're seeing the response from people based on the president, directly talking to us about what we're dealing with now, which is COVID-19, the virus, how our nation's going to heal from this and how we're going to come back. What has the response been like, particularly with the communications department?
Well, I think it's been exactly what we expected that it would be. And that is because this president has a way of communicating with people. And to heck with the partisans in Washington, D.C., the bureaucrats, the diplomatic corps, they're foreigners to him. This is a man who knows how to communicate directly to men and women who work for a living, who are out there building things with their hands or working the land. And what you saw last night was the president communicating to the American people. But also what I would say is you heard the American people asking questions that matter to them and not the typical questions you would hear from the mainstream media, who are only consumed by process stories and inside Washington, D.C. baseball style stories. That's not what the American people focus on. That's not what this president focuses on. And so what I think you saw last night was the president doing what he does best, which is communicating directly with the real working American men and women out there. And that's something that the Democrats and their allies in the mainstream media just don't get.
Well, and yeah, speaking about the Democrats, and you're right about the American worker and the people that are out there that really are so concerned now, Mark. They're wondering, where's my next paycheck going to come from? Are my kids going to go back to school? Will the schools reopen so I can get back to work? I mean, these are real issues. Is the price of meat going to continue to rise? Like me, going to the store one night, there was just like one pack of like chicken thighs, like the whole entire meat section was empty, so there's issues there. The commissaries, military personnel, now they're rationing meat there. So the president's doing everything he can with the administration to get our nation back on track, because we're dealing with something we've never dealt with before in this sense, right? Which is this pathogen, this outbreak of COVID-19. But now we're looking at the Democrats and what they're doing. And, Joe Biden, it appears that they're really nervous about Joe Biden. We're seeing stories in The Hill now that Hillary Clinton and Obama may run on a ticket. What is that all about? I mean, these rumors have to be coming from somebody, within the campaign. Do you think the Democrats are going to try to figure out a way to maybe move Joe Biden to the side and find someone else to replace him? Or what do you think's going on here?
Well, I never put it past the Democrats to change the rules, to do whatever they want to do at the moment that they want to do it. Just ask Bernie Sanders. How many times can they change the rules to set the stage against him? But it looks like, barring something extraordinary, Joe Biden is their nominee. And I've said it many times. Look, the Democrat Party didn't settle on Joe Biden as their nominee. They settled for Joe Biden as their nominee. He is the same bad candidate that he was 3 months ago when they left him for politically dead. He can't even do a virtual town hall meeting in his basement without relying on his notes. So it's clear that he's not up to this. And when you contrast what he's doing in his basement to what our Trump team is doing online virtually, or what you saw the president himself do last night at that Fox town hall, the communications is night and day. And just to put a little bit of a point on it, in the month of April, we did online broadcasts every night of the week, usually about 8 o'clock at night on Team Trump. We attracted 63 million people to watch those events every night. Joe Biden couldn't even get about a fifth of that. And by the way, Joe Biden is the one who's actually starring in his own programming. We're doing it with folks like me and other folks who are not the president of the United States. So that should give you a serious warning about the amount of enthusiasm that is going on for Joe Biden when he can't even beat campaign officials and surrogates in online programming.
Oh, well, that's certainly a great point. I mean, I talked to Laura Trump about that, and she, you know, when she was on the show here at the Sarah Carter Show, and she was adamant about how much work and how much, I guess, volunteer effort has come from across the country to really make the campaign accessible to people all over the country, even though they've been on lockdown. And I think that was the really important thing for her, is that, look, even though we can't be out at a big rally, we can't be there together, we can be there together online. Is that kind of what you're seeing? And are you utilizing, have you learned anything from this? Are you utilizing any more tools that you thought, wow, this was something I wish we would have done in 2016?
Well, absolutely. I mean, obviously, don't get me wrong. We love the rallies, and we cannot wait until the president can get back out there on the campaign trail and do the rallies, because there's nothing like it that I've ever seen in my career in politics. But there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes, beyond the rallies, even when we were able to do them. And that work has continued. So that's why you continue to see the record fundraising. You continue to see the fact that we have attracted now over 300,000 volunteers in just the last month and a half. And to put that into perspective, we had 750,000 volunteers for the entire 2016 election. We have added more than 300,000 just in the last 6 weeks. We now have well over a million volunteers. We've made 20 million phone calls to potential voters to help make sure they get the information that they need. It's really remarkable. Things that we weren't doing until the end of the election cycle, even as back in 2018, we're now doing in April and May. And again, to put a fine point on it, we have such a huge advantage right now, not only in terms of the data and the operations on that side, but even the fundraising. If Joe Biden raised $1 million a day from every day between now and Election Day, he still wouldn't catch us. That's a huge lead we have. And by the way, we're not stopping.
Wow, that is a huge lead. That really puts things in perspective. What are some of the bigger challenges, Mark? I mean, are you guys seeing any challenges? I'm sure you are. I mean, this is something completely new. Everybody is still pretty much on lockdown, even though some states are opening up. What are some of the challenges that you're trying to overcome with this?
Well, I think one of the biggest things we've got to do is recognize that the playing field is changing because of the coronavirus. And so while, yes, we have changed the way we campaign right now, I'm very positive we will get back to our normal campaign mode come later this summer and into the fall. And then we will continue to build on not only what we did digitally during the lockdown, we'll add back those elements of the traditional campaign. But also, when you take a look around the country right now, and you see people who are taking to the streets, and we are hopeful that they are doing so in a responsible manner with social distancing, but they are exercising their rights to petition their government, to air their grievances, and to defend their own rights that are guaranteed to them. What's going to happen in those states as many of those Democrat governors continue to overreact and violate people's fundamental rights? Is it going to activate a new patriotism, a new America First that all of a sudden realizes that it's President Trump who's always had their back, who's always fought for their rights. Those are new people that we can reach out to, and we will, whether you're in California, whether you're in Michigan, or even in another deep blue state. If you're fighting for your rights, President Trump is still going to fight for you. Now our job is to go find them and get them.
So where can they go? Before I let you go, where can the listeners go if they want to get involved, if they want to hear more about the campaign, if they want to dedicate more of their time from home helping the campaign out? Is there a particular website they can go to, or is there some place they can make contact with other people in their local community so that they can be involved in the election process, even if they're still at home?
Well, two things they can do. First, download our brand new app. It was the number 4 or 5 app last week in all of the world. It's Trump 2020. You can get it on the iPhone or the Android platforms. Download it, sign up. You can get all the latest information. You can stay in touch with our online programming. You can even sign up and earn points. And if you get enough points, you can get a picture with the president one-on-one right there with you. You can also go to armyfortrump.com, sign up for armyfortrump.com, get the training, and it will help you reach out to your neighbors, your friends, to help build that army that is going to reelect the president.
So this is what we know now, folks. We know, based on insurmountable evidence, that the dossier, which was used by our U.S. intelligence, as well as our federal law enforcement, the FBI, was built on a pile of lies, built on a pile of lies by both the Russians, we believe, and just Christopher Steele himself, who fabricated a lot of the sources in his dossier. That appears to be the case. And our nation was literally divided and has been ripped apart by lies. Think about this. Instead of the Democrats and the people who bought into all of these lies saying, whoa, wait a minute, let's get some clarity here. Let's inform the public of what's been going on here. And let's accept the fact that we were wrong. They've chosen not to do that. So it's going to be up to us, truth tellers, and it's going to be up to Attorney General William Barr, as well as John Durham, to do their job, expose it, shed light, disinfect it, so that we as a nation can move forward. And we can expose the truth. The truth, both what's happened here in the United States and with the Five Eyes, that is our allies overseas, and what happened there. We have to be very careful from here on out, because that kind of power, that kind of ability should not be in the hands of any one agency or any one person. And especially in a democracy where we entrust both these agencies and departments with the tools to protect us, to not be used against us, people. That is what we cannot afford. So thank you so much for being with me today. Thank you for being here at the Sarah Carter Show. It means so much to me. Please go on your favorite app and rate us. Give us a 5-star rating. And also, don't forget to go to sarahacarter.com. That's sarahacarter.com for the latest stories. And follow me on Twitter at @SarahCarterDC. America, I know we're still on lockdown. I'm going into week 6, but we can do this. We're going to get through this together. Thank you so much. God bless. We're taking the story back.